Thank you again, praise team, for helping us out. Thank you, Bill. One of those little small world things. Bill prayed for Charlie Pommelier over there in Afghanistan. Charlie's CEO is actually my nephew-in-law, Zach, which was kind of one of those interesting, weird things. But I know Zach's wife and kids are eager to have him back home here pretty soon. But if you have your Bibles, Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and we're going to start reading at verse 16. Another thank you I'm going to put out there right now, even though, you know, it's not till next week. Chuck was scheduled to preach next week for me, you know, and then I was going to kind of transition into Christmas sermons. Well, he's not going to be able to do that. So Gary Evans, I sent out a desperate plea. And Gary said, yeah, I'll do it. So we're going to hear from Gary next week. Looking forward to that. But appreciate him standing in and stepping into that slot too. So Ecclesiastes chapter 3, starting at verse 16, reading to the end of the chapter. It says, moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice there was wickedness, and in the place of righteousness even there was wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. So as one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? And so I saw there is nothing better than a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? In 1947, a man named Simon Wiesenthal formed an organization, a volunteer organization, to help fund and prosecute Nazi war criminals. During the next 40 years, Wiesenthal's organization helped track down more than 1,000 war criminals, including the former commandant of the Treblinka death camp. What was Wiesenthal's motivation? He had plenty of good reasons. During World War II, he spent the last 3 years of the war in a series of labor and concentration camps. The Nazis killed 89 members of his and his wife's Jewish families during the war. But when asked for the reason for his work, if you had had an opportunity, he's passed on now, but if you had had an opportunity to sit down and say, Simon, why are you doing what you're doing? He pointed to one story, one experience that happened during the war. One day, two Nazi officers rode to the site where the prisoners were excavating rock, and one of them grabbed a Jewish man and made him stand back to back with another Jewish man. Had a guard bind the two men together with ropes, and then just as calmly as he were swatting a fly, he pulled out his gun and shot through the first man's head into the head of the man behind him, killing them both with one bullet. And then he turned to the other officer and said, see, I told you we've been wasting 50% of our bullets. Can you imagine that? Simon Wiesenthal's response to the atrocities he experienced was his assertion that God is on leave. This was the only way that he could begin to understand the focused, unfeeling violence of the Nazis. God must be on leave. He must not be available to help. And you know what? Sometimes we look at our world and we're tempted to think the same thing as Simon Wiesenthal. We see a place like Syria, where millions of innocent people have suffered, hundreds of thousands have died. You see refugees forced to flee their homes. We see people get away with crimes or receive a different standard of justice because of their wealth or their position. This past election displayed more than one situation where there seemed to be tampering with ballots to swing the vote one way or another. All of these examples and more are pictures of injustice in various forms. It's all around us. And because it's so prevalent, I think sometimes we're tempted to really wonder where God is in all of this, and when is he going to do something to take care of all this? The author of Ecclesiastes is wondering the same thing. And so as we turn to our series of messages on Ecclesiastes entitled Finding Meaning in This Futility, in This Meaningless, in This Vanity that we see so often in life, we come to the end of chapter 3. And the last verses of chapter 3 build on the previous passage at the beginning of the chapter. And if you remember last week, Ecclesiastes 3 begins with this amazing poem about times and seasons that remind us that there is a time and a season for everything under the sun. But then the chapter goes on and reminds us that God is in charge of those times and his seasons. God is sovereign over that. He has put eternity in our hearts, but he has not given us the understanding to make sense of all of that. God is the creator, not us. God is the giver of good gifts, not us. God is the one who is sovereign and not us. And God's sovereign rule over times and seasons prompts the verses we will look at this morning. Because the preacher of Ecclesiastes, looking out at the world, and like us, he sees injustice and he wonders, if God is the Lord of times and the Lord of seasons, why doesn't he do something about this stuff? Like I said, there are times when we are tempted to ask the same thing. So I invite you to join me this morning as we examine the problem of injustice. And watch the preacher wrestle with this. And this is important. This is hard, though, too. It's hard to face injustice because injustice challenges our faith that God rules the times and seasons. Injustice is this kind of thorn that we can't seem to pluck out because it's always bothering us. The other day, I was cleaning out our raspberries, and I got a little raspberry thing underneath my skin, you know? I can't dig it out. It's not real annoying, but every once in a while, I'll bump it, and it's like, oh, there it still is. There it's at, you know, type of thing. Injustice is like that. I mean, there are just times in our life where we are just reminded of how ugly, how sinful, how unfair all of this is. And if we're not careful, we can sit there and go, where's God in this? What's going on? Why doesn't he do something? How will God respond to injustice? How should we live our life as a result? Let's find out. This is another one of those passages, as I mentioned, in Ecclesiastes that has a clear progression of thought, but doesn't necessarily lend itself to some fancy rhyming three-point outline, all right? The passage starts with the problem in verse 16, and the problem is this: injustice lives. Injustice is alive and well in the world, and the preacher sees it and exists in the most surprising, the most unlikely place. Verse 16 is another one of the preacher's under the sun observations, you know, that continue this theme of questioning whether there is profit in life. Under the sun, at the level of earthly activity, what does the preacher see? He sees injustice, and to make it worse, he sees injustice, it says, in an area where there should be justice. He sees injustice in the place of justice, in other words, in the courts. Even there, in the place where people should be able to come in and be guaranteed justice, he sees wickedness. In the place where a righteous decision should be made, he sees evil. And the implication here is that guilt and innocence are somehow being confused in Jewish courts. And the innocent are found guilty, the guilty are judged innocent. Justice ought to be about punishing evil, about rewarding good, and thus maintaining righteousness among God's people. But that is not what the preacher sees here. In fact, although it's not really borne out in the English translations, because, you know, the English translations kind of smooth this out a little bit, the Hebrew original is kind of choppy, and it's almost like this outrage is just kind of boiling up here. Hebrew is rather abrupt. It's choppy. It's almost if the preacher is so outraged that his emotions outpace his ability to articulate the words. The shock he feels is not that these things exist, but that they exist in a place that is supposed to be reserved for justice. Why is there injustice in a place that is reserved for justice? What kind of thing might he be seeing? Well, probably similar to things that we've experienced. Maybe there's a judge that takes a bribe. Maybe there's a lawyer that misrepresents the facts. Maybe there's a witness that lies under oath. Maybe there's a murderer that gets off scot-free. Throughout the world, courts of law. If you walk into courts of law, typically you're going to see something like this. Maybe not quite this grand. This is a statue, obviously, outside. But this sculpture is very familiar, Lady Justice, right? Typically, this one is not, but typically she's blindfolded. She holds scales in one hand. She holds a sword in the other. And the blindfold is supposed to represent impartiality, judging without passion, without prejudice. The scales represent fairness, the sword, swift and final justice. But here in Ecclesiastes, it seems like the preacher that Lady Justice has had her blindfold off, her scales lopsided, and her sword stolen. That's what's going on. And the obvious response to his outrage is for the preacher to ask, like a man like Simon Wiesenthal would ask, where is God in all of this? If God is in control of things, if God is the creator, if he is the sovereign Lord of times and seasons, which we just saw last week, where is he when injustice rules in the very place where justice should be guaranteed? Where is he? The preacher's unspoken but implied question lead him to two observations, two truths. Here's the first one. Verse 17. God judges. The preacher has some understanding, some faith that God will judge and make things right. The preacher counsels himself here. He speaks to his heart here, his inner being. And what does he assure his heart? He says that God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. This is a profoundly biblical statement. This is a confession of truth. Like every aspect of this world that is not in harmony with God, this present reality filled with injustice cannot last. God will bring it to judgment. The Bible over and over and over again asserts that God is the ultimate guarantor of justice. It's going to happen. God sets out the times for human activities, but he also sets out the times for his actions, his judgments, and his actions are the decisive ones. His actions are the sovereign ones. Now, on one hand, while this verse is a wonderful, true confession, for some people, maybe for some of you, it's a statement that raises another question in us, and that question is this: if God's going to judge, then how long, O Lord? Right? How long must we wait? When is this going to happen? Yes, there are times where justice is visible in our lifetime. You know, maybe you had a situation where that manipulative boss got fired, or that corrupt politician gets sentenced, or that dictator falls and is judged by his people. But there are many, many, many more times when it seems like to us the person who is practicing injustice has gotten away with it. And in those times, we're sitting there and we're waiting for God's justice and we're trusting that that's going to be there. There's going to be a time for it. But there's still that question. How long? When? Why does God tarry? When will he bring justice? That question is in our heads. It appears to have been in the preacher's head because he's got a second response to the injustice that is around him. His first truth is, yes, God judges. The second truth is different. He notes in verses 18 to 21 that God tests. The preacher suggests here that God waits for his justice because he wants people to see that they're beasts, that they're animals. He wants us to see our true character with a hope that we put away our illusions and turn and trust him. Again, in verse 18, this preacher speaks to his heart. In verse 17, he assured his heart that God will judge. Here in verse 18, what the preacher says to his heart is very, very different. He notes that God is testing human beings, that they themselves will see that they are just beasts. God's desire in allowing injustice, withholding his justice for us, is to see our true nature. It is true that in many ways, human beings are just like animals. Now, some of you right now are insulted by that. I get that. Others of you are sitting there going, I have theological objections to that. What about a verse like this, Pastor Jeff? where Genesis 1:26, where it says that human beings are created in the image of God. Doesn't that set us apart from the animals? Or what about places like Psalm 8, 5, and 6, where he notes that humans are created a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned with glory and honor and giving dominion in the world? Isn't that even more evidence that we are not beasts? And all that's true. I'm not denying that. The preacher's not denying that. Human beings are special. There are some profound ways that we are different from animals. And the preacher's not denying that. But his point is different. His point is this: just as there are some profound ways that we are different from animals, there are also profound ways in which we are the same. For some example of those ways, take a look at your Bible in verses 19 and 20. In these verses, the preacher makes a comparison between human beings and animals, and he highlights their similarity. And notice the frequency of the word all in these two little verses, 5 times, highlighting the ways in which we are the same. What are those ways? He begins by noting that what happens to the children of men and what happens to the beasts is the same. First of all, we die the same. As one dies, he notes, so does the other. Every creature dies. Secondly, we have the same breath, the breath of life, and yet that does not prevent us from dying. Our position as human beings does not give us any advantage here. In fact, it is so much the same that the preacher notes again, as he had so many times, as he will again and again and again, on the vanity or the futility or the elusiveness of this. Well, it would seem that human beings should have an advantage under the sun from an earthly perspective. In this area, we do not. We die like every other created being. And third, we all go to the same place. Now, the place here, I think what he's thinking about is not necessarily heaven. It's not necessarily hell. Some have suggested the preacher is talking about Sheol, the Old Testament place of the dead, and that's a possibility. But I think the meaning's even more basic here. I think what the preacher wants us to see is we all go to the same place, the dust, the ground. Look at verse 20. All are from the dust and all return to the dust. It doesn't matter what kind of creature you are, whether you're the ugliest warthog in Africa or the most beautiful woman in America, after death you're going to return to the dust. And so while human beings can do so many things that animals cannot do, nothing we can do, nothing we can make changes those facts. Our mortality, the fact that we all die, that we all return to the dust, that we are ultimately created from, it makes us much more like animals than God. And I know that's maybe hard for some of us to think about, but that is what the preacher is saying. We are more like animals than we are God. And that's his point. And there are theological reasons for all of this. Look back in Genesis chapter 3, and you see the story. We all know the story, right? Adam and Eve sin. Why did Adam and Eve sin? Because they wanted to be like God. Isn't that the reason we're given in Genesis 3? Because they ate that fruit because they believed the lie that eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil will make them like God. That is what the serpent says to them. And what's the result of that? Here's the short version. We all die like beasts because we wanted to be like God. Right? We all die like beasts because we wanted to be like God. And the curse of Genesis 3 upon human beings makes sure that we are in the finite mammal category of life and not the transcendent God category of life. Pastor Tommy Nelson put it this way. He says, there's a greater difference between you and God than between you and the dust mites that live on your skin. And it's true. Apart from Jesus, apart from the salvation that God offers us, that is true. And so verses like this make us painfully aware of our mortality. They make us painfully aware of our true nature under the sun from an earthly perspective. They remind us of our place in the universe, and they spur us on to depend on God, because you know what? Without Him, we are like beasts. We die. We have no hope of eternity with Him. I read about an order of Trappist monks who faced their own mortality this way. Together they dig a grave. And every day they go out to that grave and they peer over the edge and they ponder their own mortality. And one of their number dies, they lower him into the grave, they cover him with dirt, and then they dig a new grave. And they begin the ritual all over again, never knowing for certain who and when the next will die. The fact is, we need to live our lives in the face of death. We should be constantly reminded of our own mortality. The reason is that is not to bring about hopelessness, it's not to bring about despair, it's to drive us to God, the only one who has an answer to that. Only in God, only in Jesus Christ, can an answer be found to the problem of mortality and the power of death. So all of this comparison leads the preacher in verse 21 to wonder what happens after death. Does the spirit of man go upward to God? Does the spirit of the beast go down into the earth under the sun from an earthly perspective? He doesn't know, right? Despite the plethora of books out there at the bookstore about somebody's temporary time in heaven, and I want to encourage you to avoid those books at all costs if you possibly can. If you've ever noticed, none of them say the same thing, right? They all have different stories of heaven. How is that possible if they're all going to the same place? Right? Despite that whole genre of books, there is no one today who has a direct, firsthand, empirical evidence of what happens to the human spirit after death from the standpoint of under the sun. I'm not talking about faith. I'm talking about what we can see. And while the preacher is not denying life after death, he's really not sure. He's kind of agnostic here. He doesn't know. From his perspective, in his observation, which if you remember, again, limited to under the sun, he cannot know, he does not know. And again, this just builds on his case about the futility of life. The fact that life under the sun has no profit. Death renders every quest for gain and every advantage under the sun pointless. The problem the preacher faces is the problem of injustice. Injustice not only exists, it exists in places where justice should be found. And so he makes two observations as he's wrestling with that. First, God will judge. Yes, that is true. But second, God withholds judgment, so we'll be reminded of our true state. We'll be reminded that we need him. And all this brings us to our conclusion in verse 22. And its conclusion is one we have seen before. Enjoy life. He notes, as he's noted before, that there is nothing better than for man to rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. If justice cannot be found in the present, if the timing of justice in the future is uncertain, then humans should take advantage of every opportunity for its sake, finding joy in it, you know, every opportunity for enjoyment presented to them now. We're to live life not in selfish gain, not to try to gain some advantage, not to try to claw some profit out of life, but for its sake, finding joy in it, receiving it, and as we saw last week, receiving it as a good gift from the hand of God. And an interesting twist, considering how the preacher has just compared us to animals, please notice this. Only human beings can follow the preacher's advice here. Yes, humans work, animals work, but only human beings can enjoy their works and the results of their labor. Think about that. I mean, a beaver can build a dam, he can build a house, he can't sit down after a hard day's work, thank God for his job, his family, and his food, and then enjoy all he's accomplished, right? Beaver can't do that. But we can do that. And according to the preacher, we should do that. Now, maybe at this point in time, some of you are tempted to, you know, kind of check out on the preacher. You're reading this and you're going, wow, in the face of injustice, injustice is so horrific. It's so, you know, this conclusion seems kind of weak. Maybe you're tempted to criticize him or even pity him for the things he doesn't know. Things that we know as believers. As a result, it would be easy not to pay much attention to what he has to say because, well, you know, Solomon, his perspective is so limited, you know, he doesn't understand who Jesus is. I want to tell you that would be a mistake. Let me tell you why. Because even people like us, Christian believers, who live in the hope of resurrection still need to live a life between birth and death. And we need to live that life in the right spirit and in the right way. Our tendency is to live it with this illusion that we are in control. But we've seen more than once in Ecclesiastes that death mocks that whole pretension in us, doesn't it? We think we're in control, along comes death, wipes it all away. And death is a significant reality and needs to be a significant reality in our lives, even as believers. While we might know, yeah, heaven is our ultimate destination, I get that. Heaven's our ultimate reality, I get that. I'm not denying that. You know, the preacher reminds us here that the present is important. How we live our life here is important. And this is a warning for all of us who get so wrapped up in the future, we don't enjoy this life for what it is, a good gift of a gracious God. And yes, while we might understand more than the preacher about how things one day will be, I get that. It seems to me that we often understand less than him about what that signifies for faith and life now. After, I mean, the Bible has not been given to satisfy our curiosity. Oh, I'm curious about the future. I'm going to go look in the Bible and find the answers. The Bible has not been given to satisfy our curiosity. The Bible has been given to us to engage our lives. Even the New Testament, if you look at the New Testament, you read about the resurrection in the New Testament, the resurrection does not appear primarily as an idea about the future. Oh, it won't it be wonderful to have this idea fulfilled? It is the foundation of hope on which we build this life right now. That's what the resurrection is, right? So let's live our lives, as the preacher suggests, finding joy in the things like work, not in order to find gain, not in order to squeeze some kind of selfish stuff out of it, but as a grateful response to the good God who has given us this life. We got to go back to our text for one more phrase because we're not quite done. There's one more phrase in verse 22. It's an intriguing one. It's a rhetorical question, a question, of course, with a assumed answer. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? The answer, of course, is assumed in the preacher, no one. Since the details of the future are unknown, who is able to help human beings see what will come after death? Who can help us see what else there is for us as human beings? Isn't that an interesting question? When I read that, when I studied that, I realized that the preacher has spoken here better than he knew. This is one of those places in the Bible where the author, especially in the Old Testament, speaks better than he knows. He probably didn't know what he was saying. The Holy Spirit did. I have full assurance of that. But he probably didn't realize what he was saying. But he has just set the table here for Jesus, hasn't he? You see that? For the preacher, the future remains veiled. Yes, for us as well, much of the future remains veiled, especially the details. But as Christians, as one who knows Jesus, we can add to his understanding. You see, we do know one who is able to help us see what else there is for human beings. There is one who can show us, yes, in broad strokes, but also assuring strokes, what will come after death. And it, of course, is Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And so you might ask, what might Jesus say to the problem of injustice? What might Jesus say to the problem of death? Let's start here in 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 10. Jesus is the one who has abolished death and brought life and immortality to the world through the gospel. Yes, that abolition is not completely realized yet. Yeah, I get that, but one day it will be. There is life beyond the grave for all who believe, for all who place their trust in what has been done on the cross. As with regard to justice and dealing with the injustice in the world, that too is in Jesus' hands. Jesus assures us in John chapter 5, verse 24, that God has placed, he says, the Father judges no one, but he has handed the responsibility of judgment over to the Son. And as the final pages of Scripture assure us, judgment will come. For some, that will be a matter of standing before the throne and finding their names missing from the book of life. They will be destined for eternal separation from God. Others will find entry into a new heaven and a new earth, a place where everything will be made right, where God will be present and ruling, where every tear will be wiped away, where death will not exist, and there will be no more mourning or crying or pain forever. These truths and more are part of the fabric of our faith. They should be woven into our daily life. They should give us hope in the face of the injustice that we see in life. But we have to admit, as human beings, even with these truths, and they are comforting, injustice still remains a mystery at times, doesn't it? We still wonder why God doesn't do something sometimes. We know he's going to do something someday. We just wonder why it's not now. We still struggle with injustice. Personally, I'm angered, for example, being in the foster system when I see kids suffer for the sins of their parents. I'm angry as a citizen when I see, for example, the democratic process corrupted, where counties count more ballots than they have registered voters, for example. That drives me nuts. And you know what? Those things are nothing compared to the injustice human beings have faced in places like Mao's China or Nazi Germany or Rwanda or places like Syria today. Even with the fuller picture of Scripture, there is a sense where some of this remains a mystery. We just have to leave it in the hands of God, because you know what? Injustice challenges our faith that God rules the time and seasons, and that challenge is still there. It will always be there till the day we die, probably. And we have to trust that God has it. The Bible's big story reveals that there will be judgment. It reveals that justice will prevail, a perfect justice, not some kind of twisted human justice, a perfect justice. And even though we may see no visible evidence of these truths right now, our position in light of that must be a position of ruthless trust. Jesus Christ and our faith in Him provides a place for us to stand and a place for us to hope in a way that observation of life under the sun cannot provide. And so how do we respond to injustice? We need to live in hope, the hope of the resurrection, the hope of the end of death. We need to live in ruthless trust that Jesus will one day make everything absolutely right. And we want to live in the joy that the preacher so values, seeing life as a gift of God. And in doing those things, we will both glorify God and give others a testimony of how life should be lived under the sun. Praise team, if you could come up and lead us in a closing song, and then we will.